the deeper I go in my knowledge building on this beat and the more stakeholders I can talk to with different points of view, hopefully makes me a better communicator and able to better discern the right word to use.
That's Sarah Matusik. Sarah covers the Mountain West for The Monitor from her Denver base, and she writes a lot about issues surrounding immigration. Immigration has shaped America one way or another since the days of the New World. It has translated to opportunity. It has spawned periods of policy debate and surfaced legal and human rights issues under several U.S. administrations. If you don't have a border, President Trump has said, dating back to his first administration, you don't have a country. Few would debate that. Less clear may be what enforcement under the law should look like today in the United States in very practical terms. There are deeply held beliefs to be heard and probed, respectfully and with fairness. This is Why We Wrote This. I'm Clay Collins. Sarah, a return guest, joins me today to talk about some of her recent reporting, including from the roof of an ICE field office in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Clay. Thanks for the invite.
So at the risk of being overtaken here by news since we record out ahead a little bit, there are reports now of a shakeup at Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and it's not the first agency change, but it also involves the reach of Customs and Border Protection. And it looks to be rooted in dissatisfaction from the very top with the pace of deportation. Can you talk a little bit about what's at play here and how it looks in a historical context?
Yeah, you're right, Clay. We are expecting Border Patrol officials to take over the role of immigration and customs enforcement officials at ICE field offices across the country. And that's the conclusion that multiple outlets have reached, starting with the Washington Examiner, Fox News, LA Times, along with my own sourcing. The sense is that the administration is not satisfied with the rates of arrests and deportation so far. Trump, you might remember on the campaign trail, he promised the largest deportation operation in American history, while fewer than 1 million deportations are expected this year, compared with 14 million unauthorized immigrants in the country that we think are living here now. And so by applying more aggressive Border Patrol arrest tactics in the interior, which has typically been the terrain of ICE, we may see those arrest numbers increase. Border Patrol has been trying this out in places like California and Chicago. But I do want to remind our listeners that an arrest doesn't automatically become a deportation, right? There are laws, processes, sometimes even international relations issues that can get in the way of deporting unauthorized immigrants, even though the administration has already arrested them. Homeland Security has said it's deported more than 527,000 unauthorized immigrants so far, though it's not completely clear how the administration is counting deportations because it's not publishing that data systematically, broken down into subcategories like we got under the past administration. Agencies like ICE, which is part of DHS, will publish standalone data snapshots in press statements when it wants to promote certain numbers. And that, of course, raises questions around accuracy and transparency. Lastly, just for comparison, though, under the Biden presidency in fiscal year 2024, there were fewer than 300,000 deportations by ICE alone. I just caution that we may not be able to do an apples-to-apples comparison with the more than 500,000 deportations the current administration is reporting.
The murky data, obviously, as you say, makes it easy to support whatever narrative you want it to support. Immigration has obviously become a huge story globally. It shapes political races. In the United States, there's a spectrum of public opinion that runs from, you know, no human is illegal, to the notion that being undocumented is an issue that can be sorted out through processes, all the way to the idea that immigrants, certain kinds of immigrants in particular, are a threat to American security, economy, even identity. How do you acknowledge that spectrum of perceptions in your reporting?
First of all, I want to make it clear that I do want to talk to everyone. that's one of the best parts of this job. As you well know, Clay, you get to cross over these political no man's lands to talk to the other side. You know, in DC this summer, for instance, I was interviewing an unauthorized immigrant one day, then the acting director of ICE another day on that trip. And I know I'm not the first Monitor reporter to raise this, but if you peel back layers of rhetoric in your interviews, you actually begin to identify values that a lot of opposing parties actually have in common. The acting head of ICE, Todd Lyons, who's a career law enforcement officer, you know, he says his officers are removing criminals to improve public safety. A lot of immigrants have come to the U.S. through both illegal and legal means to improve their own safety. The agriculture sector in this country, which relies heavily on unauthorized labor, those guys will also tell you that a steady labor force is key to the safety of our food supply or national security. So what would it look like for all these groups to dialogue at that level of values? I'm not sure, but I'm trying to get there. And maybe some listeners at this point are rolling their eyes right now because I sound like Pollyanna. But I'll offer one example of what I'm getting at here. One of the unauthorized immigrants I interviewed in DC actually did, in part, support President Trump's crime crackdown in the city. And you might remember that involved scores of federal agents and other states' National Guard. This source said he had a friend who had been brutally mugged on the streets of DC. He was aware the city had a crime problem, and few locals would deny that, right? But what this source objected to was the government's broad classification of people like him as serious criminals. This source goes to work, then goes home. He said he crossed the border illegally several years ago for a livable wage here, the chance to get an education here. Now there doesn't seem to be a clear way for him to legalize his status, and the administration wants him out. But again, he had some overlap with the administration in wanting more public safety.
Clearly, storytelling is about individual people and families and places. You went over this on an episode you did about a year ago, and you characterized a lot of the pushback on immigration as being more about issues like the rate of change and the way immigrants enter. I'm hearing somewhat that the story has changed a fair bit in the year since we spoke. And I'm wondering now if you pursue different stories in order to illuminate different avenues.
Yeah, I think I am pursuing different stories, but I'm brought to them in the same way. I try to be driven by questions I have rather than answers I think I have about a given subject. And you're right. When we spoke last year before the election, I said I didn't think Americans were against immigration wholesale. It was more so blowback against the rate of change. Under the Biden presidency, millions of immigrants were let into the country after crossing the border illegally or given temporary permission to enter and work. And since then, illegal border crossings have dropped precipitously from hundreds of thousands a month along the southwest border to thousands a month. And the government, meanwhile, has surged the military to the border while surging the border patrol further into the interior. But I will say that I think the country is still reacting to a dramatic rate of change, but this time it's about the change in immigration enforcement, whether that's ICE arrests at immigration courthouses or Border Patrol arrests outside Home Depots. Because while the government has surged the military to the border and the Border Patrol has come up from the border expanding arrests in the interior alongside ICE, that's now coming up against what ICE has typically done, which is targeted arrests of criminals, right? The most serious public safety and national security threats in the interior. That actually takes a lot of intelligence gathering and planning of operations, making sure that that person is deportable, which is a totally different MO from what Border Patrol has had along the border, right? Rounding up big groups of people they assume have just crossed in illegally. Now school teachers, neighbors, business owners are caught up in this widening deportation dragnet. And so immigration enforcement is hitting closer to home for a lot of Americans in new ways. I think what's also changed is that there is a lot more fear. Immigrants whose future in the U.S. is uncertain are often very afraid to talk to the media, and I think that's totally fair. Now, even retired immigration officials are also afraid to be named in stories because of doxing and other security concerns. Mm-hmm. I also understand where they're coming from. I've had sources fall out of stories or asked to scale back their attribution because of these concerns. Mm. And, you know, journalist to journalist here, it's taken some mental vigilance to make sure that I'm not absorbing that fear and anxiety from sources secondhand. Sometimes that looks like taking lots of short breaks in the workday, stepping outside, texting a friend. Mm-hmm.
I want to swing into your Portland reporting, Sarah, because though Chicago and Washington, LA and Memphis have drawn the Trump administration's scrutiny, that city, Portland, in some ways sets up as one of the more interesting showdowns, not just because of the visual impact of inflatable frog costumes, the tactical frivolity, as I've seen it described, but you got some really good access there to a field office rooftop with some federal agents. You get good access in general, from a ride along with the Border Patrol in Vermont to an interview with the acting head of ICE, which you mentioned earlier. You've built up your sources among immigrant communities and you've developed your Spanish language skills. What goes into the work of getting and maintaining access, even given what you're talking about with sources sometimes, you know, flaking out?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of access, I just ask. And if I don't hear back, ask again, then maybe again, but nicely. You know, sometimes I ask myself, what would I pursue if I were just a slightly bolder person? Hmm. And then I just do that. For the Portland story, which took place at an ICE field office there that's been the site of protests for months, that's an example of a story that, again, started with a question I had. I was reading about the Trump administration wanting to send in the Oregon National Guard against local Democrats' wishes, similar to what he did in California, to protect federal property and personnel. But I thought, well, there's already a federal agency tasked with protecting federal property and personnel across the country. It's called the Federal Protective Service. It's part of Homeland Security. So I reached out to Homeland Security Public Affairs in an email asking if I could report with the FPS in Portland. And then 2 days later, I heard from the Federal Protective Service directly with a yes. And it's rare in my experience that that access happens that fast, right. But I was grateful.
So take us deeper into that Portland reporting experience, which I gather had some tense moments along with some revelatory ones.
Yeah, I ended up essentially driving a getaway car, but I need to rewind to get to that moment. So this ICE facility in Portland had been partially boarded up, and the administration has alleged property damage by protesters when things have turned violent intermittently. So the only way into the facility was driving in, I was told, on this Sunday afternoon. And I had to arrange with public affairs ahead of time so that law enforcement personnel would be ready at the gate to open it and get protesters out of the way so that I could drive in without incident, pass through this Sally Port, and park in the facility's garage. So that's what I did after spending some time earlier that day talking to those very protesters that were yelling at the building I was entering. Mm. And inside the building, I got to interview a Federal Protective Service official there, but no other federal personnel were made available for on-record interviews. I had a public affairs chaperone there the whole time. I saw there was a gym inside the building. There's a small detention space with a few cells that I was not allowed to photograph. But I did notice a sign on at least one of the cells encouraging immigrants in English and Spanish to self-deport. Hmm. We went up on the roof where we met a few federal agents stationed there. And I will say, beyond the Federal Protective Service, other federal agencies, including the Bureau of Prisons and Customs and Border Protection, are also stationed there to kind of beef up the security of this space. Hmm. And by that time, during the day and early in the evening, only a few dozen protesters had been there. You know, there was some yelling at the federal law enforcement who, again, had to manage the entry and exits of every vehicle that came in and out of this building to make sure that the protests were out of the way. And I was there reporting at this ICE facility that day with another reporter from a conservative outlet. He had somehow walked into the building without needing a car, but now that it was getting late at night and we were both interested in leaving, more protesters had gathered, and he was afraid of being targeted if he was seen walking out of the gate exposed. He had earlier that day stood on the rooftop with me and was kind of sharing barbs back and forth with the protesters, it sounded like, from my vantage point. Huh. But that was part of his own MO. And so he was afraid of being targeted, so I offered to drop him off at his hotel. At this point in the evening, it's dark outside. The crowd is thickening. We got into my rental car in the facility's garage. I'm behind the wheel, and he's in shotgun. And I remember out of the corner of my eye seeing him slowly reclining the seat, so he was laying flat out of eyesight of the window. And we had to wait for a signal from our public affairs contact that it was clear for us to exit the garage, turn the corner to enter this sallyport leading out of the building. And just as we did, the gates opened and immediately protesters swarmed right in front of the gate. I was told to stop. So I was sitting there watching the protesters watch me as I gripped the steering wheel in this sallyport. I want to pause for some context, Clay. Mm-hmm. Less than 2 weeks prior, a shooter opened fire at another ICE field office in Dallas and fatally shot people in a vehicle at that facility, sallyport. Mm. These were immigrant detainees. CNN later reported that 2 out of the 3 shooting victims died. The shooter may have conflated that van with ICE, and I had watched for several hours that day as protesters assumed everyone in vehicles entering and exiting that building were also affiliated with ICE. In front of me, I saw law enforcement officers pick up 2 protesters by their arms and legs, appear to detain them, and walk them back towards the building. Eventually, after several tense minutes just sitting with my foot on the brake in this overhang, the crowd was pushed back by law enforcement. I was told to go, and I sped out of the building with my colleague still out of sight next to me in shotgun.
Wow. Not the kind of day you thought you'd have when you woke up that morning.
Yeah. Just briefly, I want to add that no one targeted the car. We were safe. But I definitely had a lot to chew on that night about what seemed like guilt by association in the protesters' eyes by my having been granted access to the ICE facility I was covering. Also, ironically, the most aggression I witnessed at the facility that day seemed to be provoked by my own exit.
Mm. There's so much packed into that anecdote about a lot of things, including, you know, media comportment. Media coverage obviously does so much to shape perceptions about immigration and all of the players in ways that it chooses to depict reality. So, for instance, these reports of Homeland Security Chief Kristi Noem staring down protesters in Portland, again, from a rooftop, were seen to be a little less dramatic than the phrase evokes when the camera pulled back, even though it was depicted in some outlets as being more confrontational. All of this really raises the stakes for the reporting, doesn't it? The neutrality, making sure that you get things right without adding anything.
I agree. I don't know about you, but I'll be out to dinner, enjoying a meal and conversation, and then I suddenly freeze up, second guessing whether I said calendar year instead of fiscal year to describe Border Patrol data in a story that was already published. You know, like word choice haunts me long after a story is done.
Right.
But I think in immigration reporting, it's its own can of worms. And that's not just because immigration language is always evolving, like terms do in society more broadly, but because sometimes in immigration, words can have multiple meanings, right? They have maybe a political meaning versus a legal meaning, all swirling around them. Earlier in our conversation, we talked about what counts as a deportation, mm-hmm. right? Who counts as a refugee? There's a legal definition for a refugee, but deportations is a looser term. Mm. In immigration court, deportations are called removals, right? In choosing terms, we try to balance readability with accuracy. You'll often hear from this administration the term alien. And while that may sound uncomfortable to some listeners, some readers, that's actually a word found in our immigration laws under Title 8 of the U.S. Code. Alien means any person not a citizen or national of the United States. The Monitor's style guide, which predates this administration, tells us not to use that term. Instead, you'll often read us using unauthorized immigrants. Our style guide also says that illegal should only be used to describe an action, not a person. And like alien, we also don't use the term undocumented unless we're quoting other people using those words. Hmm. The deeper I go in my knowledge building on this beat and the more stakeholders I can talk to with different points of view, hopefully makes me a better communicator and able to better discern the right word to use. You know, I run these more or less biweekly meetings with other staff members at the Monitor, editors and writers who are interested in immigration. We check in about our coverage, share source ideas, but we also hear sometimes from subject matter experts. And we've had everyone from an immigration judge, ICE spokesperson, retired ICE lawyer, advocate for unaccompanied minors come and talk to us. And I'm hoping that that's introducing even more vocabulary and nuance and vocabulary to help us get better at this language thing. Hmm.
The intricacy of the work, as you just described, it reminds me about an exchange that you and I had about this offline. Share some thoughts you've had about accreditation and the media, about who gets to say they're a journalist, and, you know, about how credentials might matter more and more in terms of public trust.
Yeah, I've been mulling this a lot lately, especially since I just started my first semester of law school part-time. It's interesting to see just how much accreditation goes into becoming a lawyer. You know, years of school, honor codes, a hard and expensive bar exam down the line, compared with what's required to become a journalist, which doesn't require any school. Mm-hmm. I went to school, but many don't, and that's fine. You know, a lot of folks just dive in and learn on the job. And while lawyers, of course, are advocating for their client, we advocate for the reader. And there's some consternation in the journalism world about how anyone with a smartphone and a platform can be a journalist now. But does that tarnish the reputation of the industry as a whole if these newer age journalists aren't comporting with traditional ethics? Mm. You know, there was a lot of stir, right, about who was signing on to the abnormally restrictive press access policies at the Pentagon today, right? And some of the media personalities in Portland have been verbally sparring with protesters, as I mentioned. And my thinking may evolve on this, but right now, I'm not against an expansion of who calls themselves reporters if it means more people are protected by the freedom of the press. Hmm. I don't think we can afford to be stingy with that precious protection in the Constitution. What we can do, though, is explain how we at the Monitor define ourselves as journalists. That's kind of exactly what this podcast series does, right? Mm-hmm. And how our traditions set us apart and why that matters. Because getting audiences to care and choose us is, of course, the million-dollar question. The only thing that I can control is my own behavior, right? My own curiosity and effort, trying to lead with an open heart and mind each day. Mm.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for coming back on again to chat, for serving the reader and serving the truth, and for all of your work on a really, really important beat.
Thanks so much, Clay. Glad to be here.
And thanks to our listeners. You can find show notes with links to Sarah's stories and her staff bio and to her highly listenable previous appearances on this podcast at csmonitor.com/whywerotethis. This episode was hosted by me, Clay Collins, and produced by Jingnan Peng. Mackenzie Farkas is also a producer on our show. Our sound engineer was Alyssa Britton. Noel Flatt composed our original music. Produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2025.